Welcome again to the Marketplace Petrostate podcast, where we ask, is the U.S. becoming an energy powerhouse? And if so, what's that mean? It's July 9th, 2013, and I'm Scott Tong, sitting at the virtual sustainability desk at Marketplace. Today, an extended interview with one of the best in the business, Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has a new book out. But first, a few numbers from the news this past week. 50,000 barrels of crude were on the train that derailed in Quebec on Saturday, killing at least five people. Oil by rail has doubled in the last 2 years, given the Canadian production boom. 50% of global oil use is for transportation. That's according to the International Energy Agency, and it's going up. Energy use for urban transport is projected to double by 2050. Life expectancies in China are 5.5 years lower in the north than in the south. Why? The North uses tons of coal for heating, according to a new study. And about 100 workers are being laid off at SolarWorld, an energy manufacturer that blames its problems on unfair competition from China. This is the Petrostate Podcast. I'm joined now by Michael Levy, Energy and Environment Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. His new book is The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. So, Michael, nice to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you.
So first, let's talk quickly about a piece of news and then your longer-run observations of energy and environment issues. The president recently gave his climate speech. He talked a fair bit about natural gas abundance and what that means, and he telegraphed potentially new rules on power plants, which are the source of 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions. But I wonder, what did you take away from that?
The big news in the speech was the president's intention to regulate greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide emissions from not just new power plants, but existing power plants. Mm. So on the one hand, this is a clear signal that they're heading down this road. They've put a timetable in place to get rules drafted, finalized, and implemented. At the same time, we heard that there will be rules, but we didn't hear what the content would be. And I think that reflects the still fairly primitive state of the discussion on exactly how you use the Clean Air Act. The other thing that does strike me from the speech is that 5 years ago, there was a basic assumption that the Clean Air Act couldn't be used to do all that much
Yep.
with carbon dioxide emissions. And the abundance of natural gas, along with falling costs for some other technologies, I think it's made it a lot easier for people to see a path to using the Clean Air Act in some fairly effective ways to ratchet down carbon dioxide emissions in the near term. I'm not sure we would be having the same conversation today if we, on the regulatory side, had we not seen these significant changes on the technology, resource, and markets dimensions.
What does that mean broadly when we think about, you know, what is going to be the source of America's electricity? How far out should we look? 5, 10, 20 years? You know, what is the right time frame and what does the change possibly look like?
Prediction in this area is very difficult.
I'm forcing you.
but certainly in the near future, if they go down the road that a lot of people have advocated, where they don't just encourage power plants to become more efficient, but they encourage them to switch between fuels, I think we'll see more natural gas used and we'll see less coal used. And eventually, again, depending on how the rules are structured and how long they're the dominant tool, we could see greater emergence of other zero-carbon technologies as those costs come down.
And just to back up this switching you're talking about, I mean, coal used to be not long ago maybe 50%, is that right, of electricity generation, and then it came down to into the 30s, and now it's come back up a little bit?
Right. Coal was dominant, and then ultra-low natural gas prices about a year ago helped gas make huge inroads so that coal and gas were both delivering a similar fraction of American electricity, about 40% each. Mm. Over the last 6 months or so, with much higher natural gas prices, still historically low but considerably higher than a year ago, we've seen gas generation back off substantially and utilities shifting back considerably to coal. Mm. What that tells us is that this idea that people had a year or so ago that gas was the savior, that we don't need policy anymore to deal with our emissions, they'll just go down by themselves, was grossly overdone. But that abundant gas still does give us an opportunity to cut emissions. We need to use the right regulatory tools in order to take advantage of that.
Okay, so let's talk a little more broadly then about power surge. I found interesting that you write of two energy revolutions.
Well, I talk about two unfolding revolutions because I think we're still in the early days of a lot of these developments.
All right.
I think people are certainly aware if there's a lot of building going on in their backyard, particularly on the oil and gas side. They're aware that something big is going on. But if you go to people in Silicon Valley who are in the thick of that similar transformation in alternative energy, they certainly feel like they're in the middle of a revolution. Mm. If you go around some parts of that and see the number of Teslas on the road, is it fundamentally transforming the amount of oil we consume right now? No. Is it the sign of pretty big things to come? It's hard to avoid coming to that conclusion.
So if we start with the fossil energy side of the revolution, the shorthand that you hear a lot, and certainly in this town we hear a lot, is we've gone from a mindset of scarcity in the U.S., from scarcity to abundance. How true or not is that?
So we certainly seem to be going from the mindset of scarcity to the mindset of abundance.
Okay.
I'm not sure that that is a wise decision to be making. We're in this odd world where we have characteristics of scarcity and characteristics of abundance. We have high prices for oil.
Yep.
And high prices tend to reflect scarcity. At the same time, we certainly are producing a lot more than we did before. We've seen historic increases, the biggest one-year increase in oil production last year in U.S. Oil history. But this is one of these weird cases where scarcity and abundance coexist, depending on what aspect of the situation you're looking at.
So from the driver point of view, the driver who would say, okay, I'm still paying your $4, you know, kind of what is driving that?
Drivers are highly unlikely to see considerably lower prices at the pump as a result of what's happening here for one very basic reason. A lot of this incremental oil supply coming out of the United States costs a lot to produce. And if oil prices were to fall considerably, you wouldn't see this production continue. You can't sustainably spur low oil prices by producing high-priced oil.
In North Dakota or up in Alberta, they need the prices to be $50, $60, $70 or more in order to make money?
Right. And there's ambiguity. Some of these wells require $100 oil. Some of them require $50 oil.
So we have this advantage for now in natural gas. And yet you say the one phrase in your book is that the impact is big but not revolutionary.
If you look at the studies that are out there on what's happening in oil and gas, they rarely predict more than a couple percentage points of additional GDP growth over the next decade. Okay, that's not a couple percentage points a year. That's a couple percentage points total.
Okay.
Those aren't trivial numbers, but they aren't ones that fundamentally change the course of the American economy. And one of the things I try to do in the book is pick apart a lot of the estimates that are out there, understand how people come to them, and use that to figure out exactly what's going on.
Okay. So there's the supply story. And then, of course, there is the U.S. demand. Is that really a really significant story going on? I remember going up to Calgary, and some economists up there were saying, you know, what we've seen is this demand destruction. North American demand has peaked for good. I mean, do you see that picture on the demand side?
I do see that picture. Since 2005, when U.S. oil production peaked, we've seen a decline in U.S. oil consumption. Some of that is economic weakness, but a lot of it is high prices encouraging people to adopt more advanced technologies, more fuel-efficient technologies, and also getting them to reduce the amount that they drive. So we have seen a big trend there.
And so what is the main benefit to the economy of us using less crude oil?
So there are two basic benefits when we use less oil. The first is that the less demand there is in the world for oil, the lower prices are generally going to be. So when I reduce my oil consumption, it has a small but real impact on the world price of oil, and you then pay less for oil as a result. So we get this society-wide benefit from less oil consumption. On top of that, volatile oil prices harm the economy. They hurt us because they strip money out of our pockets that we would otherwise be spending, and again, act almost as an anti-stimulus to the economy. And so as we reduce the average price of oil, and as we reduce the amount of oil we consume, we're less exposed to volatility. In the extreme, if we consume no oil, oil prices could triple and we wouldn't notice. We're not going to be in that place, but even reducing our oil consumption gets us there in part.
So let's talk a little about renewable energy. So you might think, okay, if we have this emerging story in fossil energy, then it would be hard for renewable energy to compete. But what is actually happening out there?
Well, we've seen in the last 4 years or so a doubling of renewable energy from wind and solar and geothermal. We've had falling prices, particularly for solar. And a big part of what it comes down to is that the price of natural gas is only one of several factors that drives the viability of renewable energy. I think of three basic factors. The first is technology. Technological change, falling costs makes these more competitive. Mm. Number two is policy. Policy support acts in a similar way to falling technology costs. You can cut the cost of a technology by 20%, or you can subsidize 20% of the capital cost of an investment. Either way, depending on the exact details, it can become competitive.
I see.
The third piece is the price of natural gas, which certainly hurts, or lower natural gas prices certainly hurt renewable energy at the margin.
Mm-hmm.
But if natural gas prices were sky high, very loosely speaking, renewable energy would be competing with the cost of coal. And the cost of coal would still be fairly low. There's also an opportunity for gas and renewables to work together. Mm. One of the main problems with renewables, at least for now, is their intermittency. The sun doesn't always shine. The wind doesn't always blow. And natural gas is easily ramped on and off in order to fill in the gap. So those pieces can, in principle, work together, even if the fine details, depending on how they're regulated, can be fairly complicated.
Okay, so you kind of put these together, and of course there is the climate question that is hovering over all of this. We've recently, passed this point of 400 parts per million as a measure of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In these international talks, there's a lot of talk of staying under 450. So we're talking about that, and in the book, you say that, setting aside whatever's happening in the U.S., we may be on a path to 1,000 parts per million. That sounds ominous.
It should sound ominous. It's terrifying. Hmm. I mean, we can't predict exactly what the planet will do in the future, but the odds are very high that if we continue on our business-as-usual trajectory, and that's a number from the International Energy Agency, we will see enormous warming, and with it all sorts of consequences for weather and for human society. And while the United States can't fix all of this by itself, we are the second largest emitter in the world, a very important piece of the puzzle. One of the things I really wanted to dig into in the book was, how do these two different unfolding revolutions fit together if you want to be serious about climate change? How do gas and renewables fit together in the electricity world? How do oil production and more efficient cars and trucks, less oil consumption, fit together in within these climate constraints that we should be taking very seriously?
Okay.
Natural gas is mostly pushing aside coal. We certainly are not building new coal-fired power plants, or at least conventional ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big boon for efforts to deal with climate change. We're also seeing gas cut in to the share of coal, though not as strongly as some people, I think, hoped for a year ago. Mm. What we need to think about is how we use gas in the near term and medium term to reduce our emissions, and how we progressively then shift ourselves to zero emissions, whether that is renewable energy, nuclear power, or gas or coal that captures and sequesters the carbon dioxide emissions and stores them underground. People talk about gas as a bridge fuel. You actually have to make deliberate moves to make it a bridge. It doesn't automatically become a bridge on the other side unless you're willing to wait 100 or 200 years, in which case you don't actually deal with a lot of your climate problems. I don't think the market alone does what we need it to do. I think it's important when you look at policy to lean into good trends in the market rather than to fight them unless you absolutely need to. And we have a good trend of switching from coal to gas that we can lean into. We have a good trend of falling costs for renewable energy that we can accelerate. And so taking these, identifying where things are going well and leaning into them a bit, I think is important.
Okay. So finally, I guess, you've been zooming back and thinking about these broader things. Which kind of public discussions do you think are are there more distractions as you think about the things that are most important?
If you're trying to ask me to talk about the Keystone Pipeline, I'll take the bait.
Well, I was going to ask you that, and I was going to ask you about fracking, but you tell me what's been overdone in our public conversation.
We don't seem to be very good at focusing on the big potential wins. So we talk a lot about the Keystone Pipeline, which would have minimal emissions impact and pretty small economic and security impact. We have, when we talk about fracking, we talk about the telegenic risks from fracking, the fact that some people can set their tap water on fire, which has been the case in a lot of these areas for a long time, rather than the real risks to surface water, to air quality, and to communities. And with limited regulatory capacity and limited community capacity, we should be looking at the biggest risks. We have these very odd conversations that don't tend to focus consistently on the biggest things. We talk about the geopolitical consequences of what's happening, and 90% of that is about energy independence, when the most interesting and consequential things that could happen are very unlikely to be related to us being energy independent, and far more likely to be related to the future stability of Saudi Arabia and the relationship between China and the Middle East, all sorts of important pieces, but don't fit into this slogan that we've been talking about now for 40 years.
All right, well, thank you. That's Michael Levy. His book is The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Scott.
And that's the Marketplace Petrostate podcast for July 9th, 2013. I'm off for a year of fellowship leave, but stay with this space. There's a whole lot more Sustainability Desk content coming your way soon. I'm Scott Tong.